Welcome, everyone, to Season 9 of Underserved. Joining us in studio today for Episode 101 is Tanya Bulkovstein, Senior Director of Engineering of E-Commerce at ButcherBox. Let's get started.
Welcome to this week's edition of Underserved, the podcast for the rest of the tech industry, where we focus on stories of tech industry leaders, their insights, and their lessons learned. And now, your host, Andrew Jalina.
Tanya, thank you so much for joining us today on Underserved.
Hi, Andrew. Thank you for having me on Underserved. It's a pleasure.
So way back when, you told me on the pre-call that your family moved from the former Soviet Union, what's now known as Belarus, to Montreal. What was that like?
It was an interesting experience. We left Soviet Union. I was a teenager. We ended up in Montreal because my dad had cousins there from before the Soviet Union was established. So he had first cousins and I have my second cousins there. We came there and I had to go to a French school, not speaking one word of French. That was a very interesting experience, being a teenager in a place where I could not understand a word going to school.
Yeah, they don't let you go to an English-speaking school when you immigrate, right?
Yes. Quebec has some interesting laws around assimilation, and immigrants are not allowed to go to English school system or even bilingual schools. So I actually did not get any proper English instruction until I went to college.
Okay. Did you try to learn it or pick it up with like TV or anything like that?
Yeah, funny you ask. I spend a lot of time watching Three's Company and Cheers in my free time after school to learn English, and also got some instruction from my second cousins.
Picked up a little English from Norm on Cheers. I like it. So when you go to college, how do you kind of decide what you want to do?
So I wanted to be a psychologist, but being an immigrant and not speaking good English, my dad convinced me to pick a career in tech. Math was my best subject in school, partially because I struggled with the language in all other subjects. And so I went into math and computer science major at Vanier College and then to McGill for math and computer science.
I've heard of McGill. A lot of folks have gone there for CS.
Yeah, it's one of two English schools in Montreal.
And so you're doing those in your majors. Like, what did you really want to do? Did they offer what you really wanted in college?
I really was interested in human factors and user experience, usability, but it was so early in the tech. There was no web yet. I just took some classes in man-machine interfaces as electives, but most of my degree was in classes that were not as interesting to me, like computer architecture and systems design and all that.
Did you have any internships or co-ops or anything like that?
Yeah, so being a woman in a computer science major had an advantage. There were so few female coming out of computer science back then that I had my peak of internships and everybody wanted to hire me. And I was not the best student, but I was lucky to land some really good internships, which then led me to get a job with one of the most coveted companies in Montreal, Bell Northern Research, a research arm of Nortel.
Yeah, I remember Nortel back in the day. What were you doing at Bell Northern Research?
So it was a research facility, so we didn't work on products. We worked on the coolest and newest technology and proofs of concept. My first team worked on GTCS. It was a graphics teleconferencing system which allows you to share your screen and annotate remotely. And also there was a video component that you could see the other people. In the 90s, it was a big deal and we got to go to conferences. I actually got to co-author a paper on the communication protocol, MCS. So it was pretty cool to be working with the latest and greatest. After a few years of that, I switched to work with the speech recognition team at Bell Northern Research. And again, that was an emerging technology, way pre-Siri days. It was pretty cool. I learned a lot. It was a little intimidating work next to the PhDs, but, you know, I was okay.
So I remember back then, like IVRs, interactive voice response systems, were almost always touch tones. And it was a real hard problem to try to understand any arbitrary human English, especially with accents and everything. Was that a challenge back then?
Yeah, so I worked on the research side back then, and it was interesting to see how they trained and tuned the systems to understand different dialects and different aspects of the language. But it wasn't until I moved to Boston and went to work on the application side at Aspect Communications, where I got involved with the IVR development and speech recognition there.
So Nortel ends up closing that division. What does that mean for you?
So I had actually was already on my way moving to Boston at that point, but they closed the division. They decided it wasn't their core technology to pursue. And a company from, I think they were based in California, Nuance Communications, came in, set up an office and took 15 engineers from Bell Northern Research from that closed division and set up a center there.
Do you want to give a shout out to anyone from your first job that was particularly helpful or instructive?
Yeah, so Chris Tolson was my very first manager, professional manager. He would encourage me to take risks, to make my own decisions, and he trusted me. And I learned the value of like being empowered to sometimes make a mistake and then go do it right, but just to own a decision-making process. So I kind of tend to follow this philosophy with my engineers, empower them to make their own decisions and take risks.
Yeah, a lot of times the engineering mindset is, I only want to do this if it's perfect and I know it's going to succeed.
Yeah, unfortunately, in reality, this is not how it works.
Yeah, it is not. So you moved to Boston. What's the biggest difference you notice between like Montreal and Boston?
I mean, it's a very different culture. People are very different here. Montreal is a very open, and I was also younger there, so it was very easy to have a lot of friends and great social life. Boston, people tend to be more reserved and, you know, it's slower to make connections. I also was in a different stage of my life at that point with kids. You know, now that I'm there for many, many years, I'm very comfortable. But in the beginning, it wasn't easy.
And so this is when you're working with Aspect Software?
Yeah, that was my first job in Boston. I did take 3 years off, which also was one of the reasons that it was a harder adjustment because I stayed home with the kids.
So you get back into the workforce, you're working at Aspect. What are you working on?
This time I was working integrating speech recognition technology into IVRs. It was a very early pre-Siri days, and a lot of people were very frustrated with using this technology. When you call and IVR tells you, please select your department, clothes or shoes or whatever else. And we could only handle a small vocabulary, but people don't tend to speak this way. So things like, I would like to, maybe shoes or maybe sales, that doesn't work very well. So we had to program special code to handle these auxiliary words. Also look for frustration or if somebody calls out an operator, an agent multiple times.
Representative.
Yeah, representative. Give me the representative now. Yeah, so we had to program it so that people don't try multiple times. As also some of our systems were trained to understand dialects or accents. Like we had one system set up in Brooklyn that was trained to handle Russian accents and another one somewhere in Texas that handles Spanish accents.
Yeah, nowadays we kind of take that for granted that no matter what, no matter where you learned English, it just kind of understands it.
Yeah, although I think some of the phones allow you to train your phone to understand you better.
I remember that on Android for sure.
You are listening to the Underserved Podcast. Underserved is produced by Maris Consulting Group, embracing the power of people in technology. For more information, visit mariscg.com. That's mariscg.com.
So you wanted to try consulting from there. Do you end up making Aspect your first customer?
Yes. So I somehow, after 3 years of working at Aspect, I said, I should try going on my own. And I left and I set up my own consulting company. And Aspect was my first client because I was one of their few speech recognition experts for IVRs. So I wrote a whole bunch of training materials for them, how to build IVR systems with speech recognition. And then I moved on to other customers. So for a few years, it was very good and lucrative. Then it kind of started drying up as the time went on with the economy taking a downturn. And also the hours were unpredictable. Sometimes you're like way too busy. And other times, you know, it's just a few hours a week. And how do you do daycare around that?
It can definitely be feast or famine.
Yes.
And when the work's there, you got to finish it. Now, you ended up taking a class at Harvard Extension School around that time, right?
Yeah. So I was home trying to work with my third child, and the web was becoming a big deal. And was kind of done with speech recognition and IVR at that point. if Siri was around, the level of technology that is now there, maybe I would have stayed. But at that time, it was just not that interesting for me anymore. I got the web bug and decided I want to do the web. So I went to Harvard Extension and took one class in web development. And the teacher, David Heitmeier, was his name, I think, was phenomenal. I learned so much in that one class that I felt like I was ready to fake it until I make it and try it out in the web world.
So before you tell us what you did there, I got to say, I also am a big proponent of Harvard Extension School. I took courses there in the late 90s. I still remember my instructor, Bruce Mole. He was awesome, like so fired up about the material that you got excited about learning. And I have a friend that actually ended up taking a ton of courses at Harvard Extension and ended up getting a degree from Harvard. And when you get the degree, it doesn't say Harvard Extension. It says Harvard.
Harvard. Yeah, for sure. Yeah.
So what do you do with this newfound web development knowledge that you got from your course?
So I went and I built a couple of websites for friends for like almost nothing, which was fine. You got to start somewhere. Then I took a contract with Commonwealth Financial for 1/3 of what I was making as an IVR consultant.
Ouch.
Ouch, yes. My friends were laughing at me. But, you know, I said, I got to give it a try. This is what I wanted to do for a while. You know, that company converted me to full-time. I didn't quite like working in the financial sector. So I, as a full-time employee, I didn't last there very long. I went back to consulting, took a few more contracts. Some of them were, you know, bigger than...
Some bigger than others?
Yeah, some bigger than others. Eventually, my pay went up with every contract. So I got closer to what I was making in the IVR world consulting. Yeah, at some point I decided it was time for me to go back to the corporate world.
But before you do that, you had one particularly noteworthy client. What was that?
Yeah, there was this little vitamin company, Ideal Health, that partnered with the Trump organization to become part of the Trump network. They thought they was going to bring them a lot more clients and revenue, which didn't pan out. But they brought me on board as a UI developer because my niche was branding websites. Basically, I could very quickly throw together a UI matching the designs. And so I had to rebrand all of their websites and their even internal SharePoint site in black and gold to represent Trump. And we had this video of Trump on the homepage.
But of course.
Which, you know, wasn't my idea, but I guess it goes with the brand.
So after that, you said you went back to the corporate world. What'd you end up doing?
Yeah, so I joined the marketing research company Afinova and as a front-end web developer. And I was the only UI person on the team of like hardcore engineers. The work was interesting. I learned a lot about how human mind works, like what attracts people to buy certain products over others, like a shelf. A position of a product on a shelf actually makes a difference. Like if you have 5 kinds of orange juices and the specific labels that, you know, and claims that they have, some do better than others. So it's very interesting for me to see that aspect of, you know, economy.
Yeah, there's a lot of psychology behind selling and that shelf space is gold.
Definitely, yeah. And we were on the research side recommending to companies how to package and brand their products. This is also where I first tried management.
And what's that like?
It was good. I realized that I did not have to be a psychologist to use psychology because a lot of management is psychology, working with people, managing people's careers, understanding differences between different people and how they operate. It was all seemed like a better path for me. Even though while I was at Afinova, I got certified as a usability analyst, thinking that this was where I was going to go with it, become somebody who runs user sessions and analyzes users and does user experiments. But I ended up not going that route.
So it's absolutely necessary work, and it's absolutely something that comes up with every major UI. But I've noticed that it tends to be very short stints. Like you come in, you make the recommendations, you say it, and then you would have to put together an awful lot of gigs and usability in order to keep yourself busy. So I think you chose well with management.
Yeah, I mean, these days there come a lot of bigger companies, especially they hire full-time UXers, but it's just kind of the same again and again. So I don't know. I'm too impatient as a person, probably. So management, I think, is a better fit for me.
So Afinova ends up getting acquired, right?
Yes, Avinova got acquired by Nielsen. The culture started changing. You know, we were very informal, this little company of 150 people. And then these people in suits came in, and it's just a different vibe working for a huge corporation. And some of the people I was working closely with left. A couple of them went to invaluable.com, and I went along with them.
And so what did invaluable.com do?
Invaluable.com is a very interesting company. They run online auctions all over the world. So we had a platform that auctioneers used to sell their products, a lot of art, but also like other things all over the world.
You're going to use eBay to sell like $10 tea bags. You're going to use Invaluable to sell like multi-million dollar paintings.
For sure. And it's fascinating. These houses would run an auction in the house with people bidding by using their paddles. But also people in other parts of the world would raise their virtual paddles to bid on the same objects. And as the auction unfolds, we would watch the bidding war going on. And we had a very big monitor in the center of our main room. And when there was something very interesting auctioned, I remember Max Ernst bronze that went for $14 million.
Wow.
Yeah, I think it's now sitting in one of the museums in Paris. Like, you literally are sitting there watching this auction happening in front of your eyes, and we're in Boston, and the auction is actually happening somewhere else, and these bids coming from all over the world.
Wow. Like, a lot of times when I've seen auctions, there's like a buyer's premium or something like that. Is that how Invaluable got paid?
Yeah. So if somebody buys a piece of art on Invaluable platform, then there is a fee that Invaluable collects.
Okay. So I imagine even if the fee's small, if things are going for $13, $14 million, it adds up.
I mean, it wasn't very common to have something of that magnitude, but yeah, I mean, it's one of the largest online platforms. And as a result, they have a lot of auction houses to work with them.
Like Sotheby's and all
that.
Yeah,
Sotheby's
guys.
And yeah.
So with this hybrid model where bids are happening online, but the real auction is in person, I imagine that might have had some problems around 2020.
Yes. So it was all great, like fascinating company. I loved my team, like working there, but then COVID hit. And the business froze because most of these auction houses were not set up to run only remote auctions, and it took them a while to figure out how to do this. So that impacted Invaluable.com a lot. And one third of my team was laid off. Another few people left for other companies. We had some salary cut. There was a leadership change, which I wasn't happy about. You know, Chewy came with an offer, and in November 2020, I went to Chewy.
Hey, sport. How was school today?
It was okay, Dad. How was work?
Ugh. Actually, I had a rough day. Leading an engineering team is hard. I mean, I have to ship new software, meet deadlines, and tackle new projects while keeping my team focused on the day-to-day. It's hard to keep up.
Jeepers, Dad. Why don't you call Maris? They're the staffing firm with the best technical resources around. They helped Billy's dad. He used to be stressed out like you. He was missing deadlines, his team was overworked, and a bunch of folks left the company because it was too stressful. But then he called Maris. And they put resources to work right away. He hit all his deadlines and freed up his team to do other work. His boss was so happy that Billy's dad got some extra time off.
Time off? Wow. What did he do with that?
He spent it with Billy.
Aww.
That's a swell idea, son. I'll call Maris today. Now, you go wash up for supper.
I mean, I remember Chewy back then. Everyone's buying a COVID pet and everyone needs toys and food and everything. They're going gangbusters.
Yeah, it was a very good time for Chewy. Yeah. COVID benefited companies like that.
And what was it like there?
So I went from being a big fish in a small pond to being a small fish in a big pond, basically. And that was my choice because I wanted to experience how a big e-commerce company operates. At first, it was not bad because I was on a personalization team leading web development for personalization and pet profiles. The work was interesting. The company is very different, and I was learning and absorbing a lot. I had a very good mentor in Pradeep, and his boss was also very good to me. They had a reorg a few months into this. Pradeep left, his boss and Sanjeev left, and I was thrown into a completely different role with a small team reporting to VP of product, who also left after a few months. So while I have an had an option to move to another organization, it was easy for me. I could not bring my team, and I was too loyal and didn't want to leave them, you know, in this weird limbo state. So I stayed, and I also kind of a year and a half into the job decided that I wanted to go back to a smaller company where I can make more impact.
And so where do you go from there?
So from there, I went to ButcherBox, which was one of the best decisions of my life.
And what did you like so much about being there? Is it kind of the people, the mission? Like, what was the first thing you noticed when you landed?
So ButcherBox has a mission to transform the meat industry, which is what really attracted me to the company. Everything we do is to service the mission, which is focused on the humane treatment of animals, environmental sustainability, farmer welfare, employee workers, and our customers. It's the first time I'm working for a company that has a mission to help the environment, and it feels really good. But it also, because the company is so focused on the mission, it's like a good company to work for. ButcherBox receives no outside funding, and it's been critical because it's allowed us to not make compromises on quality and doing what we believe in for the sake of the investors.
I knew of ButcherBox for providing high quality meat by mail, if you will. But I wasn't really aware until talking to you on the pre-call about how involved they are in like sustainability and helping the farmers make a living. I thought that was quite interesting.
Yeah, so they actually work with companies. They fund sustainable farming. They have helped with some legislative changes recently in California. The company is very involved in really making the world a better place.
And so are you concentrating mostly on the UI or the whole stack, or what are you working with for technology?
So I lead 4 web teams. It's web focused. So my engineers are either front end or full stack engineers. Somebody else manages the back end, and we work very closely with that organization. But we are focused on like everything around the website.
And you guys are moving towards integrating Shopify?
Yes, we are moving onto Shopify platform. Although it's our UI, we're not using their UI. We are headless with Shopify, but we're going to be able to leverage all of what Shopify's enterprise platform offers when we fully migrate.
That's nice. You get them to kind of handle the back end stuff, and you can concentrate with how you're interacting with the customer and optimizing that.
Yeah. So they have some nice tools like a search tool, like, analytics tools that we can leverage. And we're small, so we don't want to invent the wheel for everything we do.
So is there anything else at ButcherBox that's different from the rest of the jobs you've had in your career?
Yeah. So for the first time in my life, my manager is a woman. Leslie is very calm, collected, yet influential, while my personality is high stress. The sky is falling. So she balances me out. If I come to her with my drama, she will always bring up something that positive that, you know, look at the accomplishments we've done so far. Calms me down. It's just nice having a reporting to somebody who understands you as a woman.
Now, you mentioned way back in the co-op days, it was often an advantage to be a woman coming out of a CS program because that helped in getting hired, but it's not always easy. Why would you say that sometimes it's difficult to be a woman in tech leadership?
So nobody wants to be different. So I'm often the only woman at the table in tech leadership, and I'm also an immigrant, and it feels isolating sometimes. And I have had jobs when I didn't feel good being the only one there who is like me. So that's challenging, and I see it with other women. I've connected with different women leaders in the industry. And so statistically, women represent maybe 20% of computer science graduates, and this is already an improvement over when I went to school. It's challenging to be one of the few women in technical leadership. Nobody wants to feel different. Juggling a family and professional life is also doesn't help because majority of childcare needs still falls upon a woman in this society. And while we may have an advantage with getting a job early on, because a lot of companies try to satisfy their diversity quota, it doesn't transfer to upper leadership. And it's in fact a disadvantage because you are different. There is other reasons for why women don't necessarily go for technical leadership roles. We suffer from an imposter syndrome. I'm guilty with myself, always self-doubting, you know, am I good enough to be in this role?
Do I belong here?
Yeah, do I belong here? Exactly. Yeah. And when you're the only one at the table, it's easy to continually asking yourself that. There is other things. Women don't ask for promotions. We always think that our good work should be enough. Men ask. Like, I have plenty of people working for me now and in the past, and it is true. It's the same with salary negotiations. Women don't ask for higher salaries. They just, if they know they're underpaid, they suffer in silence. Men will ask.
Whether or not they deserve it.
Whether or not they deserve it, yes. There's just gender differences that are like still there.
Yeah.
And, you know, I myself definitely a victim of all of these self-imposed problems.
What else have you learned being a woman in technology?
I learned that it's very important to have diverse teams. I try to build teams that are culturally diverse, gender diverse, even experience diverse. You know, I always have some junior engineers, mid-level engineers, senior engineers. It gives a chance to the seniors to mentor juniors. It gives a chance for the juniors to learn more. It's just good practices. One of the probably more rewarding experiences for me was managing somebody with Asperger's. It was just amazing to see how Alex would fit in with the group with some coaching and do so much better.
How about networking and mentorship?
Yeah, so I always connect with other women, not necessarily in tech, but like at my level. I've made friends that I still keep in touch with from my prior company. So Nita, Sarah, Amy, shout out to you all. You just need people that you can, who are on your shoes, to be able to reach out to get advice on, you know, go for lunch or dinner sometimes with and talk about work and how to, you know, survive in this world.
Having a peer group can make you feel like you're not alone. Even if you are the only woman at the table at a given company, if you have a group of peers that you get together with regularly, can bounce ideas, experiences, challenges off of, maybe it doesn't feel so lonely.
Exactly, exactly. And I also try to be that person that other women in the field can reach out to and get advice from. Like, I have mentored early stage women in tech before, helping them with career advice and other things. You know, I regularly attended pre-COVID She Geeks Out events, where it's basically a tech group of women that get together. You know, I would come there with my job posting sometimes, and here I'm looking. Anybody wants to apply? You know, I'm part of the RAND leadership channel, where there is some diversity groups where I also post my jobs now. So like trying to build, you know, more diverse teams and mentor outside work. My senior women at work, I meet with them regularly. I just want to make sure that they're happy, that they don't feel intimidated, that they're fulfilled. And, you know, it's just like trying to give back to the women in tech community as much as I can.
Any hobbies you pursue when you're not at the keyboard?
I love to travel. I play piano, but travel is a good outlet for me. I like to plan vacation. I like to go to different places, experience different cultures. I've traveled a lot around the U.S. and been to Europe many times, South America. And last spring, we went to Japan.
What was that like?
Culture very, very different. It was also the first time I was in a country where I could not even read a street sign. So Google Translate and Google Lens to the rescue, and that still wasn't always enough. So we've had some interesting food experiences with like little baby squid on a plate, which looked like it was raw, that, you know, I just shoved aside and did not eat.
Yeah, they're big on sushi over there.
Yeah, so sushi was there, was good, yeah.
Where in Japan did you travel to?
So we were in Tokyo for a few days, and Tokyo was great, but it was not my favorite place. Kyoto was a lot more interesting for me. very, very culturally different with amazing temples. And it's just like completely different from anything I've ever seen. And Hakone was also really interesting with Mount Fuji view and some fascinating hiking.
That's cool. Are there any charities or causes that you're passionate about?
Yeah, I'm not as involved as I used to, but back in the early 2000s, I was more involved in the applied behavioral analysis, advocating for it, making sure that preschoolers get with autism get this treatment that very helpful and should be the first thing that parents of children with autism pursue. Ever since 2011, ARISA law was passed, and now it's insurance companies are mandated to pay for it. So it's much easier for parents to get access to this treatment for their children. So I've kind of stepped back, but I still support the Autism Speak organization. That's where I mostly donate to.
Yeah, there's been a lot more awareness and support of folks on the spectrum to help them through educational challenges or the workforce or just navigating life. It seems like there's a lot more awareness and support than there used to be 20 years ago.
Yes, for sure. And especially when with young children, there is so much difference with young children in particular. When you do the right interventions with them, they make so much progress. It's unbelievable how somebody who is not verbal at 3 years old can maybe go to a kindergarten speaking and being able to be in school and learn and then even go to college and be a productive member of the society.
Excellent. So what else have you learned?
I learned that I don't have to dot all the dots and know everything there is to know to take on a new challenge. And it's okay to learn on the job. So I used to look at every job posting and like, oh my God, I don't know, like maybe 10% of it, therefore I can't apply. By the way, men don't do this. They will apply if they meet some of the criteria.
Honestly, I almost every job posting I've ever looked at, I'm like, I'm not qualified for that. And then you find out, yeah, you were overqualified for it.
And you're a guy, so you're an exception to the rule, maybe.
I guess so.
I also learned that even my negative work experiences in retrospect were learning experience and made me a better leader. I learned to sound confident, but I don't at all feel confident.
Fake it till you make it.
Yeah, fake it until you make it. Exactly. That's my motto.
Folks, I also wanted to take a moment to let you know that we have show notes to accompany each of our episodes of Underserved. If you go to our website, underserved.fm, that's underserved.fm, like FM radio, you will see all of our previous episodes as well as their show notes, where each of our guests have shared with us some links in order to dive deeper into topics they've discussed. You can hear all of our previous episodes on underserved.fm, or you can find our entire back catalog on Apple Podcasts, Google Play, Spotify, or wherever you listen to podcasts. Just search for Underserved. So, Tanya, thank you so much for joining us and sharing your experiences with the listeners of Underserved.
Thank you, Andrew, for having me on the podcast. I really enjoyed it.
And we'll talk to everyone soon on the next episode of Underserved.
Thank you for listening to the Underserved podcast. For more information on the topics discussed and for show notes, visit the show website, underserved.fm. And please be sure to rate, like, and subscribe to Underserved on Apple Podcasts, Google Play, Spotify, or wherever you listen to podcasts.